Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 198. It's Sunday, February 12th, and I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily not like my den, because unlike usual, I'm recording out of town, out of state. Guess where I am at? Well, folks, let's start with some good news. You don't usually talk about things not happening or stopping, but in this case, Ohio officials declare measles outbreak over. This from The Hill. The measles outbreak in Ohio that infected at least 85 children since October is now over, state health officials declared last week. Most of the children who were infected with measles were unvaccinated. And as of last Friday, 36 of the total infected needed to be hospitalized, according to Columbus Public Health. Most of the cases were in Columbus and other parts of central Ohio, and 80 of the cases were in children under the age of 5. Ohio health officials said they waited 42 days, which is 2 incubation periods of the virus, since the last rash from a confirmed case before declaring the outbreak was over. This milestone fits the CDC's definition of the end of an outbreak. However, we still have test results pending for suspected cases, said Columbus Public Health. The outbreak started in October, but most of the cases occurred between mid-November to early December. Measles was eliminated from the U.S. in 2000, but those who recently traveled to countries where measles is endemic could bring in new infections. The CDC recommends that children receive their first dose of the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine between 12 to 15 months. Children receive their second dose to get the full protection between 4 and 6 years old. Other states have also experienced recent measles outbreaks, including Minnesota, which had 22 cases in the Twin Cities area last year. But this Ohio outbreak was the biggest in recent U.S. history. Glad that it's over. Okay, well, let's go big early. This from Medical Express. How a public health program can usher police and prisons into obsolescence. So there's a lot of brouhaha about the phrase of defund the police and basically the whole concept of prison abolition. But as if you listen to the show very often, you can realize that there's 2 really competing worldviews. One, public health, and on the other end of the spectrum is basically law enforcement. So it's very hard to do effective public health when we're being dominated by a law enforcement policing mentality. And this from Medical Express and from the New England Journal of Medicine, it's glad to see that such things are actually being discussed and published in prominent medical journals, something you wouldn't have seen just a few years ago. So, what is an alternative to police and prisons that builds safety and prevents violence in the U.S.? In the wake of Tyre Nichols' murder and the ongoing debate around U.S. public safety systems, Northwestern Medicine's Dr. Eric Reinhardt outlined such a plan. Reinhardt's proposal in a special February 8th report in the New England Journal of Medicine reports on the creation of a new federal Department of Community Safety and Repair to lead a national decarceration program. The program would be enabled by hiring 2 million community health and justice workers, giving preferential employment to formerly incarcerated people, as part of a national health and justice corps. The abysmal state of United States public health and safety are fundamentally intertwined, and neither can be separated from the destructive consequences of mass incarceration, said Reinhardt, a resident physician scientist in psychiatry and behavioral medicine at Northwestern University School of Medicine. We need to stop treating health and safety as if they're separate policy domains. To build either public health or safety in America, we have to build both simultaneously. For that, we need a new approach that supports communities from within. Investing in this human infrastructure is essential for progressively replacing counterproductive reliance on police and prisons, while also improving community safety, building effective systems with which to provide community-based care for people with disabilities and severe mental illness, and repairing the long-term health and economic harms that mass incarceration has caused for many of the more than 77 million people in the U.S. with criminal records. The 2,800-word special report in the New England Journal of Medicine titled Reconstructive Justice, Public Health Policy to End Mass Incarceration. In the report, Reinhart outlines a scale of the widely ignored role that incarceration, both before and during COVID-19, has played in undermining U.S. public health and healthcare, which he said now both rank worst among peer nations. Evidence also shows how poor public health and healthcare systems in turn exacerbate crime, violence, arrest, and incarceration. Reinhart reframes the movement for prison abolition as not just about dismantling oppressive institutions, but also a necessary reconstructive project of building community-based care infrastructure sufficient to usher police and prisons into obsolescence. Reinhart has been working with government officials in Illinois on securing funding for pilot programs to implement the community health and justice worker model he describes in the article. Building on a well-established success of community health worker programs for improving health outcomes and reducing healthcare spending, we are working with Illinois communities to demonstrate that the benefits these underutilized programs bring to communities aren't just about health. They are also essential for building shared safety for everyone, rather than just the privileged few. The hope, he says, is to use Illinois as a proof of concept site en route to generating broader uptake of this paradigm nationwide. So it's not just about bringing down policing or defunding the police, but it's actually moving resources to where they can best, most effectively be used to produce both health and safety. Okay, next up, a story from the United Nations, which ties how pollution affects battling antimicrobial resistance, or superbugs. Reduce pollution to combat superbugs and other antimicrobial resistance. Up to 10 million people could die annually by 2050 due to antimicrobial resistance, the UN Environment Program said in a report highlighting the need to curtail pollution created by the pharmaceuticals, agricultural, and healthcare sectors. The study focuses on the environmental dimensions of antimicrobial resistance, which occurs when bacteria, viruses, fungi, and parasites change over time and no longer respond to medicines. It calls for strengthening action to reduce the emergence, transmission, and spread of superbugs, strains of bacteria that have become resistant to every known biotic, and other instances of antimicrobial resistance, which are already taking a serious toll on human, animal, and plant health. The environmental crisis of our time is also one of human rights and geopolitics. The Antimicrobial Resistance Report, published by the United Nations Environmental Program, is yet another example of inequity, in that the antimicrobial resistance crisis is disproportionately affecting countries in the global south, said Prime Minister Mia Motley of Barbados, who chairs the UN-backed initiative World Leaders and Experts Examining the Issue. Antimicrobial resistance is among the top 10 global threats to health, according to the World Health Organization. In 2019, an estimated 1.25 million deaths globally were directly attributed to drug-resistant infections. Overall, nearly 5 million deaths were associated with bacterial antimicrobial resistance. It is expected that some 10 million additional direct deaths annually by 2050 will occur, which is equal to the number of deaths caused globally by cancer in 2020. Yikes. Antimicrobial resistance also affects the economy and is expected to cause a drop in gross domestic product of at least $3.4 trillion annually by the end of the decade, pushing some 24 million people into extreme poverty. The pharmaceutical, agricultural, and healthcare settings are key drivers of the antimicrobial resistance development and spread in the environment, together with pollutants from poor sanitation, sewage, and municipal waste systems. Inger Andersen, the United Nations Environmental Program Director, explained that the triple planetary crisis, climate change, pollution, and biodiversity loss have contributed to this. Pollution of air, soil, and waterways undermines the human right to a clean and healthy environment. The same drivers that cause environmental degradation are worsening the antimicrobial resistance problem. The impacts of antimicrobial resistance could destroy our health and food system, she warned. Tackling antimicrobial resistance requires a multi-sectoral response that recognizes that the health of people, animals, plants, and the environment are closely linked and interdependent. This is in line with the One Health framework developed by the UN and affiliated agencies. The report was launched in the sixth meeting of the Global Leaders Group on Antimicrobial Resistance chaired by Prime Minister Motley. It contains measures to address both the decline of the natural environment and the rise of the antimicrobial resistance, with focus on addressing key pollution sources from poor sanitation, sewage, and community municipal waste. Recommendations include creating robust governance, planning, regulatory, and legal frameworks at the national level and increasing global efforts to improve integrated water management. Other measures suggested are establishing international standards for what constitutes a good microbiological indicator of antimicrobial resistance from environmental samples and exploring options to redirect investments, including to guaranteeing sustainable funding. Okay, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about how climate change is affecting a vulnerable population here in the U.S. This from Grist. Even with legal protections, extreme heat and wildfire take a toll on farm workers. Mass shootings at two California mushroom farms last month drew national attention to the dismal working and living conditions imposed on California farm workers. Surveys of California Terra Garden and Concord Farms, where the assailant had worked, revealed families living in trailers and shipping containers, using makeshift kitchens and portable toilets. State and federal officials have opened investigations into the farms, where workers reported earning below minimum wage. The conditions are very typical images for California and the country, Irene D. Baracua, director of operations at Lideris Campesinas, a network of female farm worker leaders, told the Washington Post after the shooting. Now, the first comprehensive assessment of California farm worker health since 1999 demonstrates just how typical these conditions are and how climate change and widening inequality are exacerbating challenges for these workers, some of the most disenfranchised residents of the state. The landmark study by the University of California, Merced's Community and Labor Center, in partnership with organizations that serve farm workers across the state and funded by the California Department of Public Health, surveyed over 1,200 workers about their health, well-being, and workplace conditions. It found widespread exposure to wildfire smoke and pesticides, rodents and cockroaches in rental units, inadequate safety training, and lack of access to clean drinking water. Half of all farm workers surveyed reported going without health insurance, even when between one-third and one-half have had at least one chronic health condition. Even through these major climate disasters, the food supply has not been interrupted, said Edward Flores, a professor of sociology at UC Merced and one of the report's authors. But the conditions that people work in have become riskier to their well-being, and they have fewer resources with which to weather a major event. Temperatures can already exceed 110 degrees Fahrenheit in areas including the San Joaquin Valley, Imperial Valley, Coachella Valley, and Sacramento Valley, where much of the state's farming happens, and the heat is only getting worse. Meanwhile, intense precipitation events cause damage to substandard rental units, and extreme fire weather days, which have doubled since the 1980s, increase the risk of respiratory illnesses. More than one in three survey respondents, 92% of whom are renters, experienced problems keeping a house cool or warm, and about 15% encountered rotting wood, water damage, and leaks. California's Division of Occupational Health and Safety, or Cal OSHA, has various standards in place to protect workers from extreme weather and other occupational hazards. For outdoor workers, for example, employers have to provide fresh water, access to shade, and cool-down rest breaks at 80 degrees. They also have to train employees and supervisors on the signs of heat illness and maintain a heat illness prevention plan with written procedures of what to do in case of an emergency. These standards are some of the strongest in the nation. Still, they often don't protect farm workers, who report widespread violations and noncompliance. Almost half the farm workers surveyed had never been provided with a heat illness prevention plan, and 15% received no heat illness training at all. During wildfire season, 13% had to work when smoke made it difficult to breathe, often without respiratory protective equipment, as required by Cal OSHA. While state law also requires pesticide safety training to be provided in a language that farm workers understand, about half who had worked with the chemicals in the past year did so without receiving adequate training. Even more concerning, when workplaces were out of compliance with labor laws, 36% of farmworkers said they would not be willing to file a complaint. Most of the time, there was fear of employer retaliation. The fact that only 41% of the respondents had access to unemployment insurance suggests that 59% weren't documented, said Edward Flores, a very vulnerable person who has to take a job that's available to them, even if it's not up to code. As climate change intensifies, challenges facing farm workers, and especially undocumented workers, will only increase, the report warns. Whether it's record heat, catastrophic wildfires, or major floods, farm workers either have to work in dangerous conditions or they're unable to work, said Flores. They don't have the same access to a safety net. The researchers hope that as California invests in reducing its emissions and helping agriculture adapt to a warming world, the data from this report will lead to more integrated climate, economic, and labor policy. We should be thinking about a cohesive strategy so that, for example, investment in technology to improve the way that crops are produced might also be done with farmer organizations at the table, with input from health and safety advocates, said Flores. Okay, well, I'd like to switch gears quite a bit here and talk about a rising problem. From The Conversation. I treat people with gambling disorder, and I'm starting to see more and more young men who are betting on sports. As a therapist who treats people with gambling problems, I've noticed a shift over the past few years, not only in the profile of the typical clients I treat, but also in the way their gambling problems develop. In 2018, the U.S. Supreme Court made a landmark decision to allow states to legalize sports wagering. Tennessee, where I am studying clinical psychology, took advantage of this ruling, and in late 2020, the state legalized online and mobile sports betting. With most sports books offering betting apps, my clients are finding it more difficult to quit gambling than ever before. Unlike other forms of gambling, such as playing roulette or slots at a casino, these apps are on their phones and in their pockets, accompanying them wherever they go. This availability makes it much harder to resist any urges that might arise and presents unique challenges for helping clients reduce their gambling. A new type of client emerges. When I first started treating people for gambling disorder in 2019, my clients were usually older and gambled in casinos, with slot machines and card games among their favorite forms of gambling. They also tended to be poor and often talked about how they began gambling to make some side money, viewing it as a second job. Many of them had retired and would say things like, "Going to the casino gets me out of the house," or "The casino is like my Cheers," a nod to the popular watering hole in the eponymous sitcom. That all changed when sports betting was legalized in Tennessee in November 2020. Since then, I've noticed that my average client has started to look different. I'm now providing therapy to younger men, mostly in their 20s, who are seeking treatment for problems with sports betting. These clients tend to earn more money and be wealthier than my previous clients, a pattern that sports betting researchers have observed. Several of them reported being avid sports fans or having a competitive streak, and they thought they could, quote, beat the system due to their extensive sports knowledge. Many of them started betting on sports after hearing promotions for various betting companies. Even if you're a casual sports fan with no interest in betting, you can't miss these ads, which regularly air during televised sporting events. For example, some ads for FanDuel, one of the more popular sports betting ads, highlights a no-sweat first bet, with new users eligible for a risk-free bet of up to $1,000. There's also a social element to sports betting. One client talked about betting on sports as a way to bond with relatives who also gambled. Similarly, a few college students I've treated told them they started betting because they wanted to fit in with their fraternity brothers. And the apps don't make it easy to set limits. But once gambling issues begin, it can be hard for these clients to stop. Most of them started by placing smaller bets on a single outcome. Over time, they start to bet more to recoup their losses. Before they knew it, their bets had increased, with many not realizing how this change even happened. Betting apps are available on any smartphone and are connected to clients' bank accounts, making it quick and easy to deposit more funds. This often leads to clients to lose track of how much money they have lost. As one client told me, "It's easier to spend money in these apps because you never really see it. The transactions are all done electronically." These apps do not make it easy for those with gambling problems to sign up for cool-off periods or self-exclusion. Cool-off periods allow the user to set a time frame, from a few hours to several months, where they'll be unable to log into their betting account. Self-exclusion allows the user to ban themselves from the app for longer periods of time. Specific exclusion lengths differ by state. In Tennessee, there are 1-year, 5-year, and lifetime ban options. While many apps have these features, My clients often have to search online for the information, and even when they do find it, they can't figure out how to put these guardrails in place. If they wish to set a cool-off period or ban themselves from all sports betting apps, they must do so from each app, one at a time, which can be tedious. It's impossible to avoid sports and smartphones. Sports betting presents unique challenges for treating gambling problems. In addiction treatment, therapists like me often encourage clients to fill their time with activities that aren't connected to gambling or to avoid situations where they may be likely to gamble. But when gambling is available at the touch of a button, it becomes harder to determine what situations may lead to gambling, which makes it harder to figure out what to avoid. Before the apps, clients had to make plans for how and when to gamble. Now all they have to do is pick up their phone and open an app. It is also incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to ask a client to stop using their smartphone or stop watching sports. This is why I often tailor treatment to each client's needs and circumstances. Some may wish to quit altogether, while others may simply want to cut back on their gambling. This has forced me to consider other possible alternatives, such as showing them how to set screen time limits for sportsbook apps or talking about strategies to watch less sports. Most people who bet on sports don't develop gambling problems, but with so few regulations in place, advertising or otherwise, those who are the most at risk are especially vulnerable to developing problems. Well, gambling addiction, like any other addiction, can and has destroyed many lives. This next story also gets at deaths of despair, this from Medical Express. Researchers estimate cost of injury deaths of despair, including suicide, which exceeds $1 trillion annually in the U.S. Self-injury deaths cost the United States more than $1 trillion a year in medical expenses and work on quality of life losses, according to a new West Virginia University research. Comprising registered suicides and most fatal alcohol, opioid, and other drug overdoses, these deaths are predictable and preventable, said Ian Rocket, professor emeritus at the West Virginia University School of Public Health and lead investigator on the study. Suicides alone cost society $500 billion each year. Because injury deaths of despair disproportionately impact the young, their implications for the future are catastrophic. They are not only emotionally devastating for families and friends, but collectively, the losses exert adverse effects on all sectors of society. Rocket's team analyzed data from the U.S. CDC and compared changes over a 20-year period, from the 1999 to 2000 period to the 2018 to 2019 period. Researchers also utilize the CDC's medical and work loss cost estimation methods, which considers medical expenditures, lost work productivity, and future quality of life lost. They found that estimated national costs of self-injury mortality rose by 143% from almost $500 billion to over $1.1 trillion over the 20-year period when controlled for inflation. Self-injury mortality includes deaths by suicide, as well as most non-homicide opioid and other drug intoxication deaths, whether intentional or not. Estimating the economic cost of self-injury mortality can inform health planning and clinical and public health interventions, Rocket said. From a public health perspective, much more attention needs to be paid to injury prevention and control at national, state, and local levels. Pertinent policy formation and implementation, and to mass communication of safe practices in schools, workplaces, and among the general public, he added. Separating suicides from overdose deaths in research and prevention funding greatly impedes the understanding and prevention of both. Other findings from the study showed that the total national suicide costs increased 58%, from about $319 billion to over $500 billion, and that national per capita costs of self-injury mortality doubled from about $1,600 per person to over $3,400 each year. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up, we have a very interesting story on how trauma or brain injury or concussion can lead to long-term health problems of another sort. This from Medical Express. For former football players, concussion and hypertension go hand in hand. The chance that former professional football players will be diagnosed with high blood pressure, a known risk factor for cardiovascular and cognitive dysfunction, rise in step with the number of concussions the athletes sustained during their careers. The results held true even after researchers took into account established risk factors known to drive the risk for high blood pressure or hypertension, including age, body mass index, race, smoking status, and a diagnosis of diabetes. The results of the study published in Circulation suggest that high blood pressure may be yet another driver of cognitive decline, a condition strongly linked with professional football play in previous studies and believed to stem primarily from repeated head injury. The findings also point to high blood pressure as a modifiable risk factor that could halt or slow both neurologic and cardiovascular damage in former players. The research, based on a survey of more than 4,000 former National Football League players, represents the largest study cohort of former professional football players to date and was conducted as part of the ongoing Football Players Health Study at Harvard University, a research program that encompasses a constellation of studies designed to evaluate various aspects of players' health across their lifespan. Most research on cognitive decline in former professional football players is focused on neurodegeneration caused directly by repeated concussions, a prominent aspect of the game. However, the leading cause of death and disability among former football players, and among Americans in general, is cardiovascular disease, a collection of conditions that affect the heart and blood vessels. Hypertension, the most common cause of these conditions, can also gradually damage blood vessels in the brain, and over time, lead to cognitive decline. Okay, well, next up in a story that's summer related, in fact, that it gets at the fact that many chronic diseases, of course, happen over long periods of time and can be related to things that have happened earlier in life. In the last story, it was concussions among football players. In this case, it's something that happens much more commonly, pregnancy, and how pregnancy complications can heighten heart risk later in life. This from Stat News. Pregnancy complications heighten heart risk in later life. It's time to pay attention. The American Heart Association has released its 2023 statistical update, and the results are grim. In 2020, the first year of the COVID-19 pandemic, more people died from cardiovascular-related causes than ever before, a staggering 928,741 deaths. While there are many causes of this increase, one is the increased burden that COVID-19 wrought on individuals' bodies and entire systems. A simultaneous epidemic is underway, and it is important to connect the dots between the two. While heart disease and deaths are at a historic high, so too are disorders arising from high blood pressure or hypertension during pregnancy, a problem that predated the pandemic. Between 2007 and 2019, high blood pressure in pregnancy, including preeclampsia, a disorder of elevated blood pressure and protein in the urine that can cause serious complications for pregnant people and their babies, doubled in the United States. In 2021, an estimated 475,000 people in the U.S. developed preeclampsia or gestational hypertension, a related disorder. In concert, the rate of maternal mortality in the U.S. has also been rising, with the U.S. having some of the worst maternal mortality rates among high-income countries globally. Why connect these two epidemics? In addition to being a leading cause of pregnancy-related illness and death, there is now compelling evidence that preeclampsia and other complications of pregnancy increase an individual's future risk of heart disease. A landmark study published in late January demonstrated in a population of more than 1 million Danish women that those who have experienced preeclampsia are at a much higher risk of heart attack or stroke, even at young ages and fewer than 10 years after delivery. A second study published in February of more than 2 million women in Sweden showed similar findings at the population level. These population-level findings appear to translate to observable changes in individuals' cardiovascular systems. This week, another study out of Sweden shows that women who have experienced adverse pregnancy outcomes, particularly preeclampsia and gestational hypertension, have more extensive coronary artery disease than would be expected based on their traditional cardiovascular risk assessment. As noted in an accompanying editorial, there is now growing recognition that traditional cardiovascular risk calculators fall short for women, failing to account for the significant impact that pregnancy could have over a lifetime. The strong connection between preeclampsia and future heart disease, along with a record number of cardiac deaths, should serve as a warning that sex-specific risk factors are a critical component to assessing risk and preventing future disease for women. What's causing record high rates of preeclampsia and cardiovascular deaths? Some have posited that the increase in pregnancy-related high blood pressure disorders and heart disease could simply be due to more older women having babies in an aging population. That could be part of the explanation. But when age is factored into the analysis, rates of high blood pressure in pregnancy and heart disease are both climbing. This means that a 25-year-old woman today is significantly more likely to develop high blood pressure in pregnancy compared to a 25-year-old in 1960. Likewise, a 75-year-old woman today has a higher likelihood of dying from heart disease than her forebears. While all the reasons for these trends aren't fully understood, factors such as increasing obesity, sedentary lifestyle, external stressors, and even the environment may be contributing factors. Everyone, especially pregnant women and their clinicians, should start viewing pregnancy as a critical window to the future, as well as an opportunity to reverse cardiovascular risk. Among the complications in pregnancy, preeclampsia is the strongest predictor of heart disease, associated with a fourfold increase in the risk of heart failure and a twofold increase in the risk of coronary heart disease, stroke, and death due to cardiovascular disease. But other pregnancy-related complications also affect that risk, including gestational diabetes, preterm birth, and other adverse outcomes, which are now included on a list of risk enhancers in prevention guidelines published by the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology. Far too few pregnant women and their clinicians are aware of this change. By incorporating pregnancy into standard assessments for patients, clinicians can provide more personalized care and help prevent cardiovascular disease and its potentially devastating outcomes. Even simple interventions such as more frequent blood pressure checks can translate to large impacts on health and prevention. Taking a detailed pregnancy history may also inform clinical decision-making on whether to start a patient on a statin or obtain more testing. Many people with a history of preeclampsia get low-risk scores on traditional assessments and would not be recommended for more in-depth testing, like checking for the amount of calcium lining the heart's arteries, a sign of heart disease. But in the latest Swedish study, those with a history of preeclampsia had worrisome coronary calcium scores, meaning that outside of the research setting, many individuals at high risk for future cardiovascular disease are flying under the radar. We need changes at the societal level to address these crises. While there are opportunities to improve care by recognizing the impact that pregnancy and its complications can have across the lifespan, women's heart health and pregnancy health still need to be prioritized on a larger scale. Women's health is notably underfunded compared to other areas, and the effect of this lack of investment shows. There has been staggeringly more innovation in cardiology compared to obstetrics, reflecting the comparatively low resources invested in women's health. A glance at the FDA's listing of breakthrough device designations illustrates this divide. The FDA granted breakthrough status to 728 devices as of October 2022. The highest number of designations, 167, were for cardiovascular devices, a well-funded field. In obstetrics, which receives far lower funding, only 4 breakthrough devices designations have ever been granted. Gynecology has not even appeared on the list, presumably because no breakthrough devices have ever been approved for it. Women are also notably absent in clinical research. In every disease area, including cardiovascular health, women are underrepresented compared with their proportions of disease burden. This translates to less innovation for women and worse outcomes. Heart disease, as a leading cause of death for both men and women, clearly deserves substantial research funding, but it's also time to address the disproportionately low funding for women's health and the accompanying underwhelming investment, research, and progress for women's health in general, including women's cardiovascular health. Women who are equally affected by heart disease as men have unequal risks that urgently demand examination and attention. Pregnancy is a window to the future and represents a unique opportunity to start reversing these unequal risks. Okay, well, next up, I want to get to a series of healthcare stories. First up, some good news on a win. This from an email from the president of the Physicians for National Health Program. Dear Medicaid supporter, during the past 18 months, an incredible coalition of Medicare champions has worked tirelessly to push back against the privatization of our most important and beloved public health program. We've raised the alarm about the REACH program, which places third-party middlemen between traditional Medicare beneficiaries and the care they need. Despite our efforts, the program has continued to grow, from 53 direct contracting entities in 2021 to 99 such entities in 2022 and 132 REACH entities as of January 1st of this year. But in a major victory for our campaign, I'm happy to report that the growth of Medicare REACH ends today. Don't take my word for it. Listen to what Elizabeth Fowler, Deputy Administrator and Director of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, told the California Public Employees Retirement System recently. Quote, "We have no plans to open up another application period for REACH," she told the CalPERS board. "There will not be any more than 132 organizations in the model and most likely no more than 2.1 million beneficiaries." This is in sharp contrast to Fowler's publicly stated goal of moving all 36 million traditional Medicare beneficiaries into a program like REACH by the end of this decade. Why the change of heart? Because over 300 grassroots organizations from across the country, representing seniors, people with disabilities, workers, medical professionals, and community advocates, joined us in demanding an end to REACH. Because members of Congress like Senator Elizabeth Warren and Representative Pramila Jayapal pressed the Biden administration about this Trump-era program and the threat it poses to their constituents. And because nearly 20,000 advocates like you signed our petition to protect Medicare. It is important to recognize this victory, but it is equally important to continue demanding fundamental changes to the way federal policymakers conduct business. End the REACH program for the sake of the 2.1 million Medicare beneficiaries who have been assigned a middleman without their full knowledge or consent. Calling out bad actors that have been allowed to administer Medicare benefits through REACH despite long and troubling histories of bad behavior. Guard against REACH 2.0, recognizing that the policymakers who developed this program and the corporate entities that lined up to participate aren't going away. Replace Medicare Advantage and its limited provider networks, prior authorization requirements, and high out-of-pocket costs with an improved version of traditional Medicare that builds on the successful public elements of the program. And win single-payer Medicare for all, the only health care reform that is compatible with economic, racial, and health justice. Wall Street investors have been trying to get their hands on Medicaid for decades, but they've overplayed their hand with REACH. We must continue to press the issue and continue to build the kind of people power that we will need to take on an industry that is laser-focused on generating profits and indifferent to the suffering of patients. Together, we can reverse the course of privatization in Medicare and build a brighter future that includes publicly funded, publicly administered, and publicly accountable health care for all.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming. Powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, next up, I want to report on yet another bit of research that shows that cutting prices for healthcare, in this case prescription costs, is really valuable. This from Medical Express. Researchers call for prescription charge to be cut. Removing the $5 prescription charge for people in areas of high socioeconomic deprivation reduces the number of hospital admissions and the length of stays, a new study shows. The $5 charge prevents some people from getting their medication, which can lead to them going to the hospital. Some people have such low incomes and high health costs that the $5 charge per medicine is an insurmountable barrier. Results of the study published in the international journal BMC Health Services Research reveal that for every 100 people who received free prescriptions, 33 were admitted to the hospital and stayed for 208 days. For every 100 people who still had to pay the $5 charge, 41 were admitted to the hospital and stayed for 326 days. So, if you want to do the math on that, that resulted in 20% fewer hospitals and one-third less days in the hospital. simply for removing a $5 prescription charge. Sounds like a really good deal to me. This would be a simple way to reduce health inequities. If a doctor thinks someone needs a medicine and they want to take it, why do we let the lack of $5 stop them? Good question. Okay, well, next up, another healthcare story. This one about how in Medicaid, there's a huge overuse of emergency departments, emergency rooms for mental health care, which is true across our healthcare system, but this is a very large study around Medicaid. Study highlights nationwide reliance on emergency departments for mental health care. That's from Medical Express. The study is the first to examine mental health access through emergency departments for patients enrolled in Medicaid, which provides health care coverage to 90 million Americans. The disparate reliance on emergency departments among states comes amid a national mental health crisis identified by the Biden administration. Researchers tracked Medicaid data from 2018. They found that Ohio, yep, good old Ohio, Nevada, and Iowa had the largest number of per capita visits to emergency departments for mental health conditions among Medicaid beneficiaries, compared to Colorado, West Virginia, and Arizona, which had the least. Hospital emergency departments will always be a resource for people who need timely care for mental health conditions. However, heavy reliance on emergency departments for behavioral health is problematic. If lots and lots of people are going to the emergency department for mental health care, it may be that they're not finding access to care in a less acute setting. Emergency departments are trained to handle urgent and acute health needs, but they are not necessarily a good fit for the long-term well-being of people in need of mental health treatment. The study marks the first extensive use of a newly available set of Medicaid claims data, known as the Transform Medicaid Statistical Information System Analytical File, or TAF. Researchers expect the database will be a burgeoning source of research going forward. There will be a lot more coming. Medicaid is a huge, huge program that has really not received a lot of attention. So we know this in Ohio that we have a shortage of mental care mental health care providers, and that itself drives a lot of people end up being in an emergency room rather than getting care from another source under like primary care or outpatient. Okay, well, next up and lastly in my regular reporting, I want to do a couple stories on organ donation and organ procurement for transplants. And while this may not be a huge part of the healthcare system and our overall health, it's really important for the people who need them, but it's a really good example of in public health when you're looking at the population and systems as a whole, you can find out, you know, where are the bottlenecks in the system. And this is a little bit surprising because it's been a challenge to get enough organs for transplant recipients. So first up from MedPage Today, study finds wide variation in organ procurement performance. Addressing the wide variation in the performance of organ procurement organizations, particularly at individual hospitals, could help to increase the organ supply, according to a retrospective cross-sectional study. Of 931 potential organ donors identified at 13 hospitals covered by two organ procurement organizations, only 242 donors, or 26%, actually had organs received, reported Seth Karp of Vanderbilt University Medical Center and colleagues. There are many, many donors out there that are not being picked up by the system, Karp told MedPage Today, and it's due to a failure of regulation at the government level and due to a failure of the performance of the organ procurement organizations. Although thousands of patients languish on donor lists each year, Karp said, that it's a misconception that there aren't enough organs to go around. It's not that people just don't want to donate. That's simply not true, he noted. The problem instead is with the organ procurement system. So to the average American, my guess is if you ask people what the problem was getting organs, was probably getting organ donors. You know, there's been public education campaigns and, you know, to recruit people to be designated as organ donors. But it looks like the real problem is more systematic with the medical care organizations and these specific organ procurement organizations that are not even accessing. If that's representative of 26% of the actual potential that could be recovered, that is very poor performance. And in a similar story, too often we waste the gift of organ donation, from USA Today. While the United States has seen a record number of deceased donor transplants each year for the past decade, more than 100,000 patients are still waiting. Sometimes the gift of life takes too long to arrive. Many would be surprised to learn that the number of donated organs that are recovered and matched to patients is actually growing. Unfortunately, transplant programs end up declining many of these organs for a variety of reasons, including medical complexity of the organ, logistical issues, and other factors. The transplant professionals who help place donor organs must then race against the clock to find other recipients, while the donor organs become less viable with each passing hour. Last year, nearly 20% of organs recovered from selfless donors were not transplanted. The trend of organ non-use has been rising, and it was well documented in a comprehensive report last year by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. So we have a twofold problem. We have organ donors who are willing to give, and we're not even using those gifted organs. And then when we actually do get that gifted organ, 20% of the time, it's not even transplanted. Okay, well, that brings us to the segment of the show called Bonus Articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give the link at the end of the list. 15 bonus articles this week, and the first one is a third article about organ donation, this from a proposal in Massachusetts. One, asking incarcerated people for their organs is exploitive. So Massachusetts is actually trying to get prisoners to donate organs for some reduced time. And this is an ethical violation on several fronts. But also, as in the early reporting of the last two stories, particularly the first one, that shows that there's plenty of donors. They're just not, we're not getting the organs donated. We're not not taking them out and putting them into a transplant patient. So there's plenty of organ donors. We don't need to exploitively get them from incarcerated people. Okay, bonus article two. Toxic gases connected to Ohio train derailment cause concern. So we haven't heard about this. It's not unusual to get train derailments since actually most large trains, because of the mix of freight that they have some kind of toxic substances on them. So when you have a derailment, it's not uncommon to get releases of toxic substance. Now, of course, this is a good example of the overall cost that we end up paying when you have, this was vinyl chloride, which had to do with PVC, which is one of the most environmentally problematic plastics. So even having that in our chain of consuming, producing and consuming creates a problem, but one of the nexuses where a problem actually happens is when you're taking the basic chemicals to produce this PVC, in this case vinyl chloride, transporting it to the factories. If it spills over, you can have very toxic exposures. Unfortunately, one of 1,000 reasons why Ohio has one of the worst air pollution problems in the country. Okay, well, on a better note for Ohio, bonus article three, Ohioans may vote on abortion in 2023. There are several organizations that are trying to get it on the ballot for 2023. Go for it. Bonus article four, what ending the COVID emergency status actually means. Now, I've actually reported on this several times. Actually over months, but more recently I've given summaries of this. But this is actually from one of my favorites, my local epidemiologist. And they talk about it from a little bit different take than things that I've reported on before. And one of those is just simply that we won't be really collecting data anymore. We won't be doing the genomics surveillance as deeply as we've been doing before with like all the variants. We won't be tracking cases and hospitalizations on a regular basis. Not even clear whether that'll be weekly or monthly or whatever. But that's the way it goes. Okay, well, in another infectious disease potential pandemic news, bonus article five, tracking the bird flu. Experts see a familiar threat and a virus whose course is hard to predict. So far, the bird flu has really taken out a lot of livestock birds. So this is why, you know, chicken and turkey and eggs and stuff are more expensive because they're having to cull entire populations who are infected. And also it's affecting birds out in the wild. But it's a pandemic threat in the sense that avian flu, bird flu, is something that has and continues to transfer to humans and other and plenty of other mammals. And there was a mink farm that was just They had to kill the whole mink farm because a bunch of them got infected, and they're concerned, obviously, that it starts, you know, a sustained chain of transmission among humans, which could be really deadly because the bird flu has actually a pretty high mortality rate. For the humans that have gotten it, it's scary. I mean, it makes COVID look like a common cold, relatively speaking. So something to keep an eye on if you're interested in that kind of stuff. Read that article for some good background. Bonus article 6. Young people are more likely to die of heart attacks post-COVID. So this is kind of this is a good general article that gives an overview of that and talks about some of the latest research. But we know that actually the proportion, the percent of increase of heart attacks among young people was greater in the first couple years of COVID than it was among older folks as a proportion. In other words, the relative risk of dying of a heart attack increased more for young people than it increased for older people. That's because COVID is a nasty bug that is more than just affecting the lungs. It affects other systems, including the heart and circulatory system. So, good backgrounder. Article 7's a good backgrounder, too. It's actually a mouse study, which I generally do not report on, but it's a good backgrounder. New mouse study shows genes aren't the only way to pass obesity to next generation. So this is about something I've talked about before, epigenetics, which is the material that's around the DNA, which is what we usually think of in passing, you know, genes from one generation to the next. But this epigenetic material, this material that's found around the DNA, actually is what regulates how those genes are expressed. And that can be influenced by environmental, behavioral things, and even the presence of obesity and the metabolic disturbances that it creates. Those changes in the epigenetic material can actually be transmitted to the next genes. And even in these mouse studies, they've seen these results go actually several generations, not just the next generation. So an interesting background if they're interested in genetics and the biology behind that. Bonus article 8. A technicality could keep RSV shots from kids in need. This is just an example of some of the glitches that we have, like in the FDA. You need to keep updated regulations to make sure that the scientific advancements we have are actually getting to the people most in need. And bonus article 9, doctors aren't burned out from overwork. We're demoralized by our healthcare system. Something I've reported on plenty of times before. And a similar story, bonus article 10, hospitals at a breaking point. Lack of staff and resources leave emergency departments in chaos. If you've been to an emergency department ever, but even recently, you may very well have experienced that. And this is a good article written by an emergency room doc that gets at that in a little bit more of a narrative long-form style. So if you're into that, take a look. And to kind of sum up some of the reasons why we're in those states of bad affairs, bonus article 11, hail profit. The existential threat of greed in the U.S. healthcare system, or non-system, as the case may be. So if you're interested in just getting a good kind of primer on how greed creates perversities in our U.S. healthcare system, that's a good backgrounder. Bonus article 12, here's how to end the U.S. health disadvantage. Let's focus on prevention and social policy, not sick care. So the U.S. health disadvantage, which is a term that basically has been created because it's been so long-standing that the U.S. is just in a class of itself and not a good class compared to kind of peer countries, other wealthier so-called advanced economies. And of course, the spoiler alert is that it's about focusing on prevention and social policy, not sick care, but a good backgrounder. Another article that gets at how hard it is to actually create a functioning system, bonus article 13, Congress told Health and Human Services to set up a health data network in 2006. The agency still hasn't. So this is a story of a lot of difficulties in getting something through a bureaucracy and where you have diffuse authority, you know, kind of who's responsible or accountable for it. When that's diffuse, often it doesn't get done. And in this case, it hasn't. And this would have been a good example. If this had actually happened back in 2006, we would have been much better prepared for COVID. And of course, if we had it now, even after COVID, we'd be prepared for the next pandemic coming down the pike. And of course, it's not just pandemic response that this would be important. This would be important for our entire public health and healthcare system. Okay, well, if you want to really get at how to organize community, this next story is a good one for that. Bonus Article 14, the community of mothers who lost sons to police killings. So this is a good activist story of mothers who have lost their sons to police murders and how they're organizing it and responding, turning their grief into activism and action. And lastly, bonus Article 15, the country is watching. California homeless crisis looms as Governor Newsom eyes political future. So Governor Newsom in California has proposed a rather ambitious and fairly well-funded homeless initiative. But of course, the question is it going to work well? And there's risk for him politically because, of course, a lot of times doing nothing is more politically safe. If he has a grand program and doesn't work well, it could cost him politically. But hey, he's making a shot at it. And if they make progress, even partial progress, we can learn from that and build on that in the future. You can listen to this and other stories that I've reported on this show and previous episodes at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.